So when Stuart asked me to talk about oneness, I started thinking about oneness because I've never actually spoken on oneness before. So it's like, okay, what does oneness mean to me? And just realizing we think of oneness in many, many different ways. You know, when people say we're all one, I always tend to ask them, well, what do you actually mean by that? Because we mean many different things. The first, the obvious one, is the realization that we are one humanity, one species, living on a single planet with ultimately a common destiny. And that's a relatively recent realization. And I think it really was sort of crystallized by the astronauts, Edgar Mitchell, other astronauts who went out into space and saw that picture of the Earth, brought back to us this vision of oneness, of wholeness. And it's fascinating how that symbol of the Earth has become almost a spiritual symbol of our times. It's used in just about every area of life or commerce, product, spirituality, because just in itself it says something, that we are one planet, one living system. Before that, I remember growing up as a child, you know, when we looked at maps of the Earth, it was all the maps, all different colours for different nations, and you know, all the British colonies were pink and all the Portuguese colonies were purple. It was really about difference. We were seeing the differences of these are our people, these are other people, and these are people over here. And there wasn't this sense, such a sense of connection. So that's, I think, one of the first senses of oneness, which has really filtered through our society over the last 50 years. And you mentioned the Gaia hypothesis, which was the theory put forward by James Lovelock in the late 70s, that the whole of the Earth is or can be considered as a single living system, in much the same way that our bodies are a single living system, maintaining the optimum conditions for our continued existence. Our bodies keep the temperature at the right level, they keep the salinity of the blood at the right level. We're a self-regulating system. And he put forward the idea that the biosystem of the planet is also a self-regulating system. And over the years, a lot of data has come in to support that. And he called it the Gaia hypothesis. These days, it's called the Gaia theory. So it's moved a step from being a hypothesis to a theory. All the different species of the Earth seem to work together, not in a sort of conscious, deliberate way, but there's feedback systems whereby they just work together to maintain the optimum temperature, the optimum salinity of the oceans, the optimum balance of certain chemicals in the atmosphere that are optimum for the continued survival and evolution of life. And that the Gaia hypothesis or the Gaia theory has really become a sort of backbone of the environmental movement. And many organisations have Gaia in their title now. And that prompted me to explore the interlinking of humanity through computer networks, because I just finished doing my work in computer science and I was doing some of the very early networking of computers. We had a huge computer upstairs, probably took a room twice this size. The hard disks were, we had 20 megabyte hard disks, which were about this big across, and you had instructions and you put the hard disks in. We had sort of bank of about 10 hard disks readers, and you put the hard disks in. And then we had a huge cable coming down through the ceiling to this other computer downstairs, which I was working on. And we sort of sent data back and forth through this thick cable, this thick coming down through the ceiling, which probably was, you know, 1,000 times slower than your slowest USB cable. But I could see that the networking of computers was one direction we were moving in. It wasn't getting larger and larger computers, it was computers linking together and beginning to link humanity together into a single integrated system. And I call that the global brain, because from the Gaia theory, you can sort of see the parallels between various organs in the body and organs in the planet, like the rainforests work a bit like the liver. You can say the ocean's a bit like the circulatory system. You can see functions like that, parallel functions. And I was asking, well, what's humanity doing here? Because we're this young upstart. We've just been around for 1% of 1% of Earth's history. We're just a blink in the eye of Earth's history. What are we doing here? And what we are good at is information processing, because we have language, speech, can think, can reason, can share ideas with each other. We're the supreme information processors on the planet. And that led me to the idea we're like the neurons on the planet. And so we are forming a global brain. And it's been fascinating watching over the last 40 years how that's been coming about. I mean, none of us back then foresaw how it would look. We were looking at in terms of data. None of us foresaw the World Wide Web. The internet didn't even exist in those days. None of us foresaw the World Wide Web or streaming video or shopping or social media. It's just very difficult to predict the future, because you can never predict the innovations and inventions that will come out of human creativity. But just seeing that that's a way we are beginning to link together, there's a level of oneness there, that now we are just aware of what is happening in other parts of the planet almost immediately. You know, something happens in India or Turkey or Brazil and it's being tweeted about, and you know, we're aware of it within minutes, possibly even seconds. It's that fast we are interconnected now. And who knows where that's going? Just as, you know, back then, none of us had any idea what it would look like. Well, we did have ideas, but we were totally wrong, or totally short-sighted, rather. I think we have no idea where this growing interconnection across the planet is going to take us. Potentially into some sort of collective consciousness. That's another level of oneness. We're not just interconnected through the computer systems. Our actions ripple out into the world. We are interconnected in that way. That, I think, is the basic idea of karma, which its original meaning is just action. Actions we perform, inevitably, the effects of those actions ripple out and affect others. And those ripples bounce back to us in some way or another. I don't mean some cosmic accounting book that says because you did this, then this is going to happen to you. But it's a principle. It's, again, in many spiritual traditions, as you sow, so shall you reap. It's a principle. And that has come home, I think, in the whole mathematics of chaos theory, just how interconnected things are. You've heard of the butterfly effect, which is the idea that, you know, a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil could alter the weather here. It doesn't mean that every time a butterfly flaps its wings, the weather changes, but just the butterfly flapping its wings, very, very occasionally, that little disturbance of the air when the system is in a critical state is enough to send another ripple and another ripple and another ripple, and it ends up shifting the weather pattern. And they found this because when they were looking to predict weather patterns, they found most of the time the predictions were very stable, but sometimes just the slightest change in the initial condition, the slightest change, led to a whole different outcome. And I see that in human interaction, the way we are. If, you know, if you're living in a caring, compassionate, loving way, those ripples are just going out into the world. And occasionally, they're going to touch people who are in a mathematical sense, in a critical state, not critical psychologically, but just in a state where that slight influence could tip them into another way. And your being in a certain way, you could just tip them into opening up, something like that. So that interconnection we have just ripples out into the world. So that's another sense of oneness. And then I was thinking that we're all of the same substance, essentially. And we're all born of stardust. Every atom in your body, every single atom in your body, existed before the Earth existed. The atoms are created in these vast stellar explosions called supernovae. When they explode, just the intense energy of the explosion fuses together other atoms. And all the atoms that exist, apart from hydrogen and helium, come out of these explosions of stars. And they're then floating around in space as stardust. And slowly, under the forces of gravity, the dust collects together. And stars form out of that dust, and planets form out of that dust. Every atom in your body, every atom in this room, everything we know goes back, in terms of its substance, to before the Earth was created. Which also means that every atom in your body has been through a lot of other living systems. You know, it's been a bird, it's been a tree, it's been a dinosaur. It's been through 4 billion years of change and life, and here it is now temporarily in your body. Temporarily, because in a year's time, most of the atoms in your body will have been changed, and you'll take in new atoms. But one of the facts I like about this is if you take a teaspoon of water, just a teaspoon of water, and put it into the sea and stir it up, and let the sea stir it up, and come back, you know, whatever it is, 1 million years later after it's been thoroughly stirred in, and you take a teaspoon out of water out of the sea, that teaspoon's going to contain one of the original atoms that you put in. So again, this is a sense in which we're interconnected. The ways I'm sort of more interested personally is how we're interconnected in terms of our essence, our being, if you like. And there's two ways I see this. First of all, in terms of our own experience. We are all conscious beings. The one thing we know for sure is that we are conscious. And we all have very different experiences, different thoughts, feelings, perceptions, personalities, needs, fears, whatever it is. But the one thing that's common to each of us is that we are conscious. And that's something which is always there, always present. There's never a moment in your experience where you're not conscious. There couldn't be, because otherwise you wouldn't know it. It's the one permanent fact of our existence, and undeniable fact of our existence, the fact that we are conscious. What we are conscious of is continually changing. That's the impermanence of our experience. Continually changing. No one second is like any other second of our experience. It's continually changing, unfolding, evolving. And yet what is always there is that knowing of the experience. And that's what we label I, the knowing of experience. I don't mean I in the sense in which we often use the word, like I am Peter Russell, whatever, which is how I identify this body or my thought system, whatever. Though that's clearly things which can change. I'm talking about the unchanging essence. I mean, my name can change. I could say I'm British, but I'm also American now as well, so that's changed. You know, we can change anything, but it's the I that remains that is observing the change. And when I say, you know, I was this and now I am that, or we sometimes say, you know, I'm not the same person I was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. it's interesting when you look at that statement, I am not the same person I was 20 years ago. There's actually implicit in that two senses of I. There's the I that has changed. And what we normally mean by that is, you know, when you say I'm not the same person I was 20 years ago, we mean maybe my values have changed, the way I think has changed, our personality, those things have changed. But then there's the I that's saying, you know, I am not the same person as I was. There's implicit in that, that other sense of I, which is that sense of being, presence, knowing, which is always there, which never changes, which we can't define, which is, all the spiritual teachings point to that. It's undefinable, it's ineffable. And yet, it is the most familiar aspect of our being. We all know what we mean when we say I in that sense, and yet we can't actually pinpoint it. But we know what it means. We know that, you know, right now, you are the one who is experiencing this moment and the next moment and the next moment. And that I never changes. We could call it that which knows experience. It's the knowing or the knower of experience. Because it has no defining qualities, it means that what I know as that sense of I-ness is exactly the same as what each of you know. There's no difference. That sense that I know of being an experiencing conscious being must be exactly how it is for each of you. So in that, we are all one. We all share that knowing of what it means to be a conscious being. It's exactly the same for each and every one of us. You could say it's that feeling of I, that sense of I is how it feels to be a conscious being. So that's something in which each and every one of us is connected, or not connected, we are one. Some spiritual teachings talk about that as the universal self. And I think sometimes that's misunderstood, or it's understood in another way, which is that it's some self which is universal out there that we are connecting with. I see it as, no, it's a quality of self which is universal to each and every one of us. So that's something we all share, even though we live very different lives and values and personalities and needs and behave in very different ways. And that to me is an important thing of just recognizing that fundamental oneness. And another aspect of that is that everything we know, everything we experience is just an appearance in that space of awareness. And right now it seems like we are seeing this world directly, experiencing it directly. And we have this wonderful 3D, multisensory, hi-fi experience. But it's all in the mind. It's not to say the world out there doesn't exist, but all we know of it is the form, the manifestation that appears in consciousness. And what I mean by this is right now, you know, you're seeing this room and we know what's happening is light is hitting the retina, setting off electrical impulses which go travel to the back of the brain where it's analysed and very quickly, in about a tenth of a second, and very cleverly, the brain works out what is out there. It's an incredible job of processing, but it actually works out from the data coming in through the eyes what is out there and creates this, you know, coloured, three-dimensional picture. It's its own picture of the world. And at the same time, it's taking in sound, integrating what the ears are telling it and creating the sounds you hear, the sounds of my voice, the touch, the feeling, and integrates it all into this representation of the world. But it's all in the mind. In that sense, it's all a manifestation in consciousness. So All we ever know of the world is actually what is being created in our experience. As I say, it doesn't mean to say the world out there doesn't exist. But what we're discovering is the world out there is very different from the experience we have. And by this I mean, here's green, nice, bright, luminous yellow green, which is the way my brain represents that particular frequency of light to me. All there is out there in the world is light of a certain energy, of a certain frequency. The light itself isn't green. We don't even know what light is. We talk about it as energy or photons or waves. We don't really know what it is. They're just ways of describing it. But one thing we can say, it isn't actually green. It's some energy which is travelling to us. And when it hits the eye, the nerve fibres, that they're not conducting green currents or green chemicals. And the processing in the brain, there's no green there. The green is just how it's represented in consciousness. And that's true of all the colours, the sounds you hear. It's just moving air molecules, which the brain represents to consciousness as the sound of my voice or the water heater, whatever it is. So when we look at, what is the actual world like, we find it, first of all, it's nothing like our experience. And what's fascinating, the more we drill down and start looking at what is the world actually made of, which is like the task, one of the tasks of science is to discover what is the world created from, what is the ultimate substance of the universe. The closer we go, or the further we go, the deeper we go, the less of any substance do we actually find. You've probably all heard the idea that, an atom is 99.9999999% empty space. If you take the nucleus of an atom to be the size of a golf ball, then the electrons would be the size of peas flying round about 300 feet away. So an atom would be like the size of this hangar with a golf ball in the middle and peas flying around the outside, the rest of it empty space. And now with quantum theory, we realise that that's wrong as well. There's no such thing as solid particles of electrons or protons or neutrons. They're just concepts we have. And there's just probabilities of observing certain things. And it's totally empty space. There's no thing there. There's nothing there. Ultimately, all that science can say is there's information. An electron is information about something we call mass, something we call charge, something we call spin. They're just numbers. It's just information. And the mathematics describes the information, but we don't know what's really there. But there is this unified field which science is searching for. They're searching for the mathematics which describes all the fundamental forces in one mathematical formulation, which we're not there yet, but we're heading that way. But again, that says, we're all of that same essence, whatever it is, whatever that unified field is, we are all of that same essence, just manifesting as this particular form. And another aspect of that, I suppose another aspect of the oneness, is that consciousness goes all the way down. Let me say, I think consciousness, we shouldn't use the word consciousness, because we delude ourselves into thinking there's such a thing as consciousness, when I sometimes jokingly say there's no such thing as consciousness, meaning there's no thing called consciousness. When we add any SS to a word, we turn a quality into a noun in order to talk about it. But the noun doesn't exist. We could talk about happiness. What exists is the feeling of being happy, which we know, or the feeling of being sad. That's a quality. We add ness to it, N-E-S-S, to talk about it. So in language, we can talk about the quality of being happy in a general way, and we call it happiness. in the same way we talk about the quality of being conscious, and we talk about it as consciousness. But what we're talking about is that quality we actually know of being conscious. And I mention that because science these days has got interested in consciousness. There's conferences on, there was one last week and 2 weeks ago in Arizona and Tucson, the famous Towards a Science of Consciousness conference. And probably there was the other science and consciousness ones in New Mexico. There's a lot of conferences on and research into what is consciousness, and people trying to study consciousness and find consciousness, which to me is a waste of time. It's like we are conscious, and now we're looking for something out there we're going to experience called consciousness. It's like, hang on, you know, stop. You already know what you know what it means to be conscious. It's not something you have to find. It's just that quality of knowing experience, of being an experiencing being. That science is looking to discover what is it, and how does consciousness arise from the brain is the big question they're trying to solve. It's sometimes called the hard problem of consciousness. It's clear that what appears in consciousness, the experiences we have, are conditioned by the brain. So when I'm seeing this colour green, clearly there's some particular neural processing going on as a result of which I experience that colour green. And if I'm feeling sad, there's some neural processing that correlates with that. There's no doubt about that. But then people confuse the question and say, well, that means the brain must create consciousness itself, create the quality of being aware, of knowing. And that has two big problems associated with it. This is the standard worldview. The standard worldview is that consciousness arises out of the brain somehow. The first problem is, how does unconscious, insentient matter, which we assume the brain to be, or neurons to be, the atoms of the neurons to be, how does unconscious, insentient matter ever give rise to experience? It's a totally different type of phenomena. There's nothing, absolutely nothing in modern science that predicts that any of us should ever be aware. Like we should be some biological computer robot doing all this stuff, walking around, feeding ourselves, making love, all of that, without any experience of it. Why do we actually have an experience? That's the huge, huge problem for science. Any theory or model in science, to be valid, it needs to show it can predict things, valid predictions. So when they tested the Gaia hypothesis, did it predict certain things would happen? And they tested it, did predict certain things would happen. The whole of our scientific worldview does not predict consciousness, which to me says there's something fundamentally missing in the current scientific worldview. The other problem with that idea that the brain generates consciousness itself is where does that start happening in evolution? You know, I accept that other animals are conscious. I say I do. You meet people who say, you know, oh, only human beings are conscious. To me, what they're saying is only human beings are self-aware. And even that I would question. One of my loves is being with whales and dolphins, and they seem to be, in some ways, more aware than us. But even so, dogs, cats, your pets are clearly aware. When someone says to me, well, you know, dogs aren't aware, my challenge to them is, well, okay, if you have a pet and it needed to go to the vet to be operated on, would you let the vet give it an anaesthetic? Would you want the vet to give it an anaesthetic? Usually the answer is yes. They're like, well, if you don't believe it's conscious, why would you want to make it unconscious? So we assume that other creatures feel pain like we do. We don't feel the same way about pulling out the plug on our computer. You know, if the computer freezes, we know what to do with it. It's quite simple. You just disconnect the power. We don't go, oh my God, what's going to happen? It's going to feel pain. Maybe I should find some electronic equivalent of an anesthetic. Poor computer. I mustn't pull the plug. So we intuitively feel that other creatures are conscious. And the question is, where do you draw the line? You know, okay, so vertebrates, you know, all similar, fish, we have nervous systems, brains. So, you know, you wouldn't sort of, when you catch a fish, you know, anybody who fishes, you actually, I know I caught a fish once, I didn't mean to. I was out with some friends fishing and, you know, I was fishing along with them and actually caught one. It's like, oh my God, what do I do now? I've got to kill this thing. You know, it's like, we feel they're conscious. Where do you draw the line? You know, spiders, you know, I wouldn't feel good about just taking a spider and sort of picking its legs off. Just, you know, I'd happily, you know, examine my computer, but I won't disconnect, you know. So where do you draw the line? If you draw the line and say, well, okay, spiders are but worms aren't, you come up against this problem of why is there consciousness here but not there? And the position that more and more people are coming to, but still a small number of people, but it's an increasing population of philosophers and scientists, is to say that capacity to be aware is in everything. All the way down, you cannot draw a line. It's there from the very beginning of creation. It doesn't manifest as experience in atoms. It's not to say, you know, oh, rocks have feelings or thoughts, not at all, but it's saying that capacity is there in everything. And as the nervous systems grow and the senses grow, so the experience that manifests in consciousness gets richer and richer and more diverse, and the forms get more and more detailed till we end up with the forms like we're experiencing. But it leads to the conclusion that everything ultimately has that potential for experience, that capacity for experience, which again is another level of oneness that it's pointing to, that not only are we all conscious and knowing beings in that sense of having that same quality of knowingness, but it's there in everything. Even if not manifest in everything, it goes all the way down through evolution. So one of the things I'm fascinated by then is, if the universe is just an information field, it is a conscious information field. And so the whole cosmos is a self-knowing system, knowing itself, and in that knowing itself, creating for itself the experience of matter, physical form, which again ties in with what a lot of spiritual teachings say, that, you know, whether you're talking about as God, the Great Spirit, Brahman, whatever, they're all pointing to the fact that the ultimate nature of the cosmos is more of the nature of mind than matter. That the ultimate nature is an experiencing field, experiencing itself. The other thing I want to look at is how we create a sense of separateness, because we're talking about oneness and how we actually live oneness, which again is something many philosophies and spiritual teachings point towards. How do we actually live oneness? I think we need to look at how does the sense of separateness come into being. I think there's what I call the natural state of mind, which is the state of mind we're in when everything is fine, we're well fed, the temperature's right, there's no danger, when we're physiologically secure, safe, okay, and needs are met. The inner reflection of being okay physically is that we feel okay inside. We feel content. And that, I say, I think, is a natural state of mind. And in that natural state of mind, there isn't a separate sense of me and the rest of the world. The attention tends to be sort of an open, relaxed mode of attention. We're just observing the world. It's almost like being in a standby mode. You know, it's something we know when we're sort of sitting in nature. First thing when we wake up in the morning, before we start getting into our thoughts, that moment of awakening is just that open mode of consciousness. We all know it from time to time. And then what happens is there's some some need arises, or there's some threat, some danger, whatever it is, there's something needs taking care of. We need to find something, get something, or avoid something. And we temporarily move out of that natural state of contentment into a state where the attention becomes focused on dealing with the situation, getting what we want. And we naturally feel discontent. Things aren't okay. Things aren't the way we want them to be. At the same time, our awareness, as it becomes focused, it shifts from just that open spaciousness. We separate awareness into a sense of me here, usually based around me, the biological organism, and the rest of the world out there. I, this organism, need to get the world to be a certain way. I need to get food or avoid this danger or turn up the central heating. There's something that needs to happen in the world to satisfy the needs of this body, this organism. And so this sense of a separate self emerges in awareness. And it's a very useful, natural thing to happen. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. It's what we often call the ego or the ego mind. And people tend to put it down in spiritual circles. The ego, I've got to get rid of my ego, I've got to transcend my ego, and I'm still dealing with my ego, or whatever it is. The ego's great. It's there as a friend. It's actually trying to help us get what we need in life and get things sorted out. That's its job. It's basically a problem solver. When there's a problem in the world, whatever it is, we need something, there's something we need to change, there's a problem, and we move into a problem-solving mode, which is, you could say there's three phases. One is assessing the situation. What's up? What's going on? What do I need? What's wrong? That sort of thing. How do I do it? Then there's the second phase, which is making decisions, making choices, deciding what sort of action to do. And then the third phase is planning what to do, carrying it out. And that's the ego's job. And that lies behind a lot of our thinking. If you look at your thinking, I would suggest a very large part of it is either assessing what's going on. A lot of that is commentary to yourself about what's happening, what someone's thinking, whatever it is. Or it's making decisions, choices, or it's planning what to do. Most of the planning is a complete waste of time. I think it was, Mark Twain who said, "My life has been full of disasters, most of which never happened." The question is, why is it that most people spend most of our time in living in this world of a separate sense of self, interacting with the world? And I think there's two things which have come together which lead us to do this. One is we are very good at problem solving, and because we've got hands and because we've got language and not knowledge, and because we understand the world, we're understanding more and more how the world works, and we've got hands and tools and technology, we know how to change the world, then we fall into the assumption that if we're not happy, if we're not at peace, then we need to do something, change something, get something, and we're very good at that. We're wonderful, we're great problem solvers, and we're always creating new things, new solutions, new ways to do things, usually more efficient ways that make things even faster. And we don't recognize that the reason we're discontent most of the time is because there's something in our mind that's creating the discontent. I used to point out to people when I was working in the corporate world, I used to ask how many people get stressed by traffic jams. And more or less everybody would admit to being stressed by traffic jams. I then point out a traffic jam doesn't have that power. It only has the power to stop traffic moving. That's it. That's all it can do. if you're feeling stressed in what is actually the most relaxed part of any driving experience. When you think about it, being in a traffic jam, you've got nothing coming the other way, you've got nothing to avoid, you've got no looking out for pedestrians, you haven't got to worry about this. And it's actually the most relaxed bit of ever being in a car is being in a traffic jam, and here you are feeling stressed. It's because the voice in your head, and this is the voice of the ego mind that's seeing a problem here, it's decided there's a problem, you're going to be late, and if you're late, you're either going to miss the appointment, or someone's going to be upset at you, you're going to miss an opportunity, whatever it is. Being late is not going to be good. The voice of fear kicks in, the voice of fear, the body responds to that, getting prepared for action, and the hormones start flowing, you start feeling stressed. And yet what we do is we try to change the situation out there rather than looking at what's going on in here. Somebody else could be sitting in exactly the same situation saying, this is wonderful. This is a situation I've been waiting for all day. And I can sit and meditate for a few minutes, but nobody coming in with problems for me to solve. I can relax for once. And it's the same thing with our whole society is geared towards this idea that if you're not content, we don't recognize that the discontent is coming from some perceived lack in the mind. We think there's something out there. And this is the second thing. We have incredible powers of imagination that other creatures don't have, because we can think into the future and make choices about the future. You know, other animals make choices about the present moment, but we can make choices about things that haven't even happened yet. And so in our imagination, we are seeing all these possibilities of things that could happen and then try to solve the problems that don't even exist yet. So the ego mind gets triggered in human beings time and time and time again when it doesn't need to be triggered. Its function is to help us. It's an ally. It's trying to get us through this world, help us survive. That's its function, is to help us survive. But most of the time it's actually getting in the way. And I say it's behind our society. So much of what we do, when you look at it, is based on this assumption, if only I could get the world to be the way I think it should be for me to be happy. It's conditioned into us from birth, by our parents, because they didn't know any better, by the educational system, by the media, by advertising. Just about any advertisement says, you know, buy this product, this service, whatever it is, and you will feel better. What they're doing is creating a sense of lack. And it seems to work. You buy some piece of clothing, you buy a new jacket or something, and you feel better. And we think, buying the jacket made me feel better. So we learn from that, and so next time we're feeling down, we go shopping. But what I love about the internet is it's showing up a little flaw in this argument, because it used to be you went to the store and bought your jacket and you paid for it and you came out carrying the jacket and you felt wonderful. Now you go online and you search around and you find the best website and the best price and the right colour and everything. And then you press buy now. And that's the moment you feel better. And the moment your credit card is debited. You don't actually see the jacket for another 3 days. But the fact you feel better then, when you look at it, shows that it's not the getting the jacket, but you've temporarily relieved yourself of a certain discontent. So we are continually creating discontent, and then we do things to temporarily relieve us of that discontent. And that, I think, is what the Buddha saw in the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth of dukkha, usually translated as suffering, these days tends to be translated differently as either that cumbersome word unsatisfactoriness. I just prefer discontent, unease. As some of you probably know, the root meaning of dukkha is actually a negation of the word sukha. And the word sukha means to be at ease. So dukkha is actually not being at ease in the world. So for me, that's not being in the natural state of mind. It's being in the ego mind. The ego mind is never at ease. It's always looking, wanting, working things out. So what Buddha was saying is we human beings are seldom in that natural state of ease. We're always discontent for some reason or other. And there's an even deeper meaning. The root meaning of sukha is a wheel that turns smoothly round its axle, which back in those times was probably a really important thing because the wheel and the cart was the height of technology. And to have a wheel that was efficient was really significant. Dukkha is something that moves with friction and resistance. And I think you can take that into, you know, why we feel discontent is we are resisting the moment as it is. We are resisting what is happening. Things should be different. You know, I can't be happy in this situation. I'm resisting the experience of being in a traffic jam. And so that resistance is creating the discontent. And again, what so many people have pointed to is that can we just accept the present moment as it is? Which doesn't mean accepting the situation, but accepting our experience of the situation. I mean, there may be many things we need to do to change the world, but we cannot change our experience in the moment. So can we accept our experience in the moment? And then the second noble truth was that really, seeing that we cling to our idea of how we think things should be for us to be happy. And then the third noble truth I've just been fascinated by recently is Nirodha, which is often translated as cessation. You know, the cessation of suffering comes from letting go of clinging. But there's another root meaning that scholars are looking at now to Nirodha, which seems to me far more interesting. The root meaning of Nirodha, one of the root, ni means out of, in this, like we have X, to come out of something. We use the X in England, you know, to exit, whatever, to come out of. Rodha means prison. So coming out of bondage, coming out of imprisonment, which is freedom. So cessation, it is cessation, but the quality of freedom that comes with it is really interesting. In that, when you look at the, you know, the old translations, it's all about restraining the mind. We've got to hold the mind. It's freedom from the whirling of mind, freedom from the thought waves. It doesn't mean you say you have to stop them, but can they be there and can we be present to them and be free from the effect they have on us? To say that's what I'm interested in practice. Well, two things. One, how can we be free from the whirling of the ego mind? It's going to happen. It comes up again and again and again. But how can we not stop it, but learn to step out of it so that we can come back to that natural state of mind, which I would say is the natural state of oneness. And the two practices which I find valuable these days, one is whatever's going on, not trying to change it, but just the recognition that, as I put it to myself, you know, am I not the one that is experiencing this? I am not this separate self that I have constructed, that has been constructed rather. The ego mind, this separate sense of self, that I am always that sense of being which is experiencing whatever is going on, that is experiencing the anger or the delight or whatever it is, or the peace, the deep meditation or the frustration, whatever it is. But just to recognize that I am that knowing sense that is always present. And it's just a simple reflection of that fact and just turning the attention back to that sense of the knowing, the knower. And the other thing is, whenever the ego mind kicks in, there's always some sense of what I would call a constriction of consciousness, a tensing of the mind, a slight constriction. It's just if the attention is being focused, then there's a sense in which the attention is being held somewhere. You've got a job to do, the attention is there, and so there's a holding of the attention to the job at hand. And whatever that happens, you can begin to feel it. There's this slight I call it a constriction in the mind, a constriction of consciousness. And I found that one of the ways of recognizing when the ego mind is operating is you can just recognize this faint sense of tension that comes into the mind. It's always there, this sense of slight sense of tension, constriction. Just recognizing that. I think there's almost a universal law with consciousness. What you allow into your awareness begins to dissolve. The opposite to Carl Jung's thing of what you resist persists. And he was saying when you push something out, he was talking about your shadow, but when you keep something out of your awareness, it controls you, it persists. When you do the opposite, when you let it in, things tend to dissolve. Just noticing more. Whenever there's that faint sense of tension in the mind, just noticing it, nothing more. Just noticing how it feels for the mind to be slightly tense, slightly focused. And the tension begins to soften and dissolve. And as that happens, you just drop back into that open spaciousness, the natural mind. And the other thing about the natural mind, there's a quality of love and compassion there. I think it was Baba Muktananda who said, love is the secret sensation of the self. It's one of those things where I think there's a lot of meaning in that. It's secret in the sense that we're not normally aware of it. It's hidden. It's hidden because our attention is with the stories we're telling ourselves, whatever it is, the problems we're working out. So it's hidden. But it's the sensation of the self. So it's like that quality of I-ness, that pure beingness. How it feels, it has that feeling of love, which again is that quality of oneness. Not love in the everyday romantic sense, but it's just a quality of love that's in one's being. And I'm sure those of you who meditate, you know that from time to time, when you're in that deep silence of meditation, there is just that quality. It's just the love is there. It's not love for anything, which is conditional love. It's unconditioned in the sense it does not depend upon any condition to arise. It is just there naturally. And that again is something I think we all want to return to. You know, we all want to return to ease. That's something that's common to every one of us. We want to return to the natural mind. Everything we're doing, everything the ego mind is doing, is actually geared in one way or another to returning to that natural state of ease. It's, again, something that unites us all. As the Dalai Lama said, you know, in the final analysis, the hope of every person is simply peace of mind. And also, in the same way, you know, we all want to love and be loved. And what can easily happen if we're not aware of what's going on is we start manipulating other people in order to get them to love us in one way or another. It's a sad game that goes on, but the way it sort of happens is, you know, you say something to me which is meant completely beautifully, without any ego, without any sense of hurt or anything. But because I've got my own little triggers, I get touched by it, I misunderstand, I feel slightly hurt by it, totally erroneously, but I feel that way. And if I'm not really, really careful, then I'll probably respond in a way that's, you know, slightly... It can just be a tone of voice or a pause or body language, but something very slight just to let you know that I'm a little bit upset. And now it's deliberate. And now you feel it. You feel slightly hurt. And the game builds up and you end up in this vicious circle where it's sad. Two people, both looking for love, digging in at each other, saying, you know, I'm going to just hurt you a little bit to make you realize the error of your ways and love me more. And it happens, you know, whether it's personal relationships, family, friends, out there in the world with strangers. It's a game we fall into so easily and ends up in divorce, argument, fights, whatever. Simple way around it, and this really is the whole, is the Buddhist principle of harmlessness, or the golden rule, which is in just about every tradition, is to have the intention that whatever you say or do in any interaction, that the other person should come away feeling loved, respected, not hurt in some way or another, not attacked. It's basically just checking whenever those little attack thoughts come into your mind, any sense of slight attack, to make the other person in some way wrong is where an attack thought comes from. Just beginning to check those at the very start and not let them come out into the interaction. I think one of the Buddha's definitions of right speech was, if you can't say something in such a way that the other person feels good on receiving it, it's better to retain noble silence. But not in the sense of a cop-out, you know, I don't know how to say this to you, so I'm going to shut up. It's like, okay, pause and wait and find a way to say it so that the other person feels loved and cared for. And it really is caring. This to me is love in action. It's caring not just for another person's physical well-being. I think we're pretty good at that, taking care of other people's physical well-being. This is caring for their inner world, for their inner well-being, for how they actually feel, which to me is a more profound way of caring. It's very subtle. But just caring for how a person actually feels in an interaction. And when you practice that with someone, it's quite amazing the quality of love that begins to descend into the relationship. It really seems to descend in from somewhere else. This quality of the caring builds up, a real quality of love just begins to appear.